This is Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com and guest writer for Critical Hits. Tonight I had the opportunity to talk to Quinn Murphy of the Emmy-nominated website At Will. Quinn is known best for the work he has done on skill challenges and more recently on World Breakers, a concept we will be talking about later. Quinn is also a freelance writer for Kobold Quarterly, Open Design, and for Wizards of the Coast. So tonight I had the opportunity to talk to Quinn about skill challenges. We focus exclusively on skill challenges tonight. And we got a lot of information about how to run skill challenges, tips and tricks for making them work well in your game, how to incorporate them into combat, how to build monsters around skill challenges, and a lot of other different tips. So tonight's podcast is 55 minutes, and I hope you enjoy it. So why don't we go ahead and dive right in?
Okay.
What I like to do is I want to just get right into the meat, if you will. So, what are your three best and most simple tips for running great skill challenges? What's something, you know, when you have a relatively new DM or an intermediate dungeon master, what are the three tips you would give to somebody to run great skill challenges?
Well, I'll start with a big one. Actions, not skills. Right. The last thing you want to do, like I've never seen an awesome skill challenge happen where people are like looking down at their character sheets, going back and forth over their skills. You need to engage sort of people's imaginations. So, you know, like I will force people to not look at their character sheet and just, you know, ask the person to tell you what they do and then translate it. Right. You know, it's like I'm going to jump across the chasm. Oh, well, that would be an athletics check. Now, you know, now roll, you know, and then if they want to use stuff, then, you know, if you want to sort of figure out the best way to translate it, then you can start going into the skill sheet. But lead out with action.
That's a good one.
Then my second one would be to sort of to turn the action, for lack of a better word, to sort of make sure that the action is always turning. Like what can happen with skill challenges sometimes is get sort of like this treadmill where people keep just throwing like, okay, I'm going to use, you know, my perception, and I'm going to use my perception, and then I'm going to use my perception. And basically it's like, okay, well, you perceive more and more and more. They're not getting why they're using, a lot of times why they're using the same skill over and over is because as a GM, you're not turning the situation to the next scene. Oh, you see this, but then this. And it doesn't have to be a complication. Isn't necessarily they failed. Like they can succeed, but then something else goes slightly wrong. And when you change the feedback and keep sort of slightly, you know, like little mild mini failures, it gets them thinking in different ways. And then I guess the third one is bargain. That's been for some of my best favorite skill challenge sessions I've run. Basically what I do is I just let people, you know, if people want to win a skill challenge badly enough, I'll let them, but what do they want to give up to, you know, like, you know, if they really want to, you know, stop that, you know, wagon from falling into the chasm, how badly do they want it?
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, well, I want to do this. You know, athletics isn't my best skill, but I'm willing to do this. And da da da. Like, oh, you're willing to give me healing surges? Like, you're willing to do this? You know, and sort of let players sort of bid and push and sort of come up with interesting things for it.
Right.
You know, it won't always, you know, some skill challenges, like, you know, they might decide, I don't really care about it that much and I'll just let it go. But when players want something, then it gets pretty interesting.
Right, right. Yeah, the first one in particular is one that, you know, I think addresses a major problem that I've seen with skill challenges, which are when players only go after skills that they've maxed out on their character sheet. So, you know, your athletic-based, you know, strength-based fighter types are only the ones that are only going to think about everything from an athletic standpoint. Like, I don't care if I'm negotiating with a guy, I'm going to show him that I'm really strong by flipping over a table. You know,
right.
They only seem to go after, they'll come with the craziest solutions for as long as they fit whatever that number happens to be on the sheet. So I think trying to get them to think outside of their sheet and think about the action, and then hopefully not screw them when they, you know, pick a skill that happens to be low on their sheet, you know, by saying, oh, you fail and you lose a bunch of gold. You know,
well, that's where that's where
healing surges.
That's where three comes in handy, right? You can go, oh, well, you did something, you know, in that spirit of bargaining, you can be like, well, you did something that's off your sheet. If you're willing to do this, I'll let you get, you know, a slight bonus to make up for the fact that you're using something on train.
Right.
You know, so you can sort of let characters stretch, but not completely be at a disadvantage, right? Because mathematically, you're right, right? You know, like a lot of times people don't want to do the things that they're bad at, even though it's the best action or something that they would do. So you have to sort of let them stretch to make up the gap.
Right, right. How do you, if you're writing something up, and I guess there's two ways to write it up. When I talked to Chris Sims, he had the same thing. There's writing stuff up that you're going to publish, and there's writing stuff up that you're going to run at your table. So when you're putting together an adventure for your regular gaming group, how do you write up a skill challenge that you know, ties into those principles that you just described?
You know, I write them up actually pretty close to what you'd find in a WotC module. But just running, you know, because those things I described are just principles that I use. So you know, it's you know, the only thing I don't do when I'm running for my group is write the big, long, you know, flavor text description.
Right.
Because I don't need that. Right. But, you know, but everything else I'll write out, you know, I'll go through. And I usually try and make the cores of my skill challenges a little bit different. But basically, I'm just writing out, okay, what skills are useful? Mm-hmm. What skills are useful in primary? What skills are useful and secondary? And any sort of special things that go into them that they can do. And then just, you know, run it with those principles and keep all that stuff in my head.
Right, right. That's interesting. So another question that I think comes up with everybody who ever talks about skill challenges, and something that I don't think Wizards has ever directly addressed. Do you announce they're in a skill challenge? You say, you're in a skill challenge now, prepare, or do you just let it flow naturally into the narration of your story?
Well, here's my rule of thumb. If the skill challenge is going to be a departure from what they normally do, then I tell them the rule, like I tell them the skill challenge and I give them the rules more or less up front. So like if the players are in an airship and they're about to have an airship battle, well, it's time to take a little pause and be like, you're about to have an airship battle and here's how it works.
Right, right.
Right. But if the characters are just looking for something in the city, a lot of times you can just flow into it naturally. Like, you know, they're like, I'm going to look for this. Okay, you're doing that, you know, and they might not know. Like, I usually like to give them an indication, but you can do it sort of non-verbally. Like, I'll just use little counters. So they'll do something successfully and then I'll just drop the counter and they know, but I haven't made a big thing of it. But you can also just do it implicitly, just, you know, flow through it. But if it's not going to change up the action considerably to something sort of, you know, irregular or like a mini game that you've built up, I wouldn't bother.
Right. Right. When you're just starting out, how do you begin thinking about your skill challenge? Does it come just kind of in the middle of telling a story? Is it something you start with when you're building an adventure? You know, I mean, do you know what's going to happen? Like, you know, encounters are going to happen. How do they, when you're actually in the process of designing your adventure, what leads you to skill challenges and how do you write them? You know, how do you begin them? You know, how do you begin writing a good skill challenge? Like, where do you start?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really good question. I guess it starts with the fundamental question to me is the process of getting to success or failure for this action interesting, right? You know, crossing a bridge, like a crossing a sort of ratty bridge, yeah, maybe not very interesting.
Right.
You know, crossing a disheveled bridge that's on fire while being chased by, you know, bloodthirsty orcs, that's kind of interesting.
Sounds
right?
Like Temple of Doom.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, like that's really interesting, you know, and a lot of times you can take basic information. Like if you're thinking, oh, I'd like a skill challenge, I'd like something like that there. Take a normal situation that you'd have, right? Take that bridge and then just add like other complications and problems to it until you feel that it's gotten pretty interesting, right? Add the fire, add the orcs, right? And now you've turned something simple into something interesting and something worthy of a skill challenge.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so it's just sort of like get that baseline. You want to make sure that it's going to be interesting enough, has enough complications that characters are going to care about it, and then do it. Because usually if there aren't that many complications, like a skill roll or two will do it and let you move on.
Right, right. Interesting. So different people have different kinds of play groups, and I've seen some play groups that are very, I've played in play groups where people are really kind of interested in the story and interested in navigating through the tale that's being told. And some really just enjoy the tactical, you know, the mm-hmm. tactical combat. And, mm-hmm. you know, for a guy like me, even though I've got a group that's primarily, and I don't actually think, I mean, in my group, I think I've probably got a majority of people that enjoy tactical combat, but I've certainly got people that are interested in a story and kind of wish the story would evolve more. Mm-hmm. But the tactical people go to sleep anytime I do anything other than tactical combat. You know, the minute I start talking is, you know, telling a story, the minute they're like, oh, time to go. You know, let me pull out the cell phone. I think I might have a message here. And, you know, it's like anything on the internet is more interesting than what you're going to tell me. So, I found a technique, but I'm curious, like, how do you draw them back into your story in skill challenges? Like, for the people that just generally, like, as soon as they think they're in a skill challenge, they just lean back in the chair and stare at the ceiling and then say, like, I'm, you know, and they just roll 20s without even looking at the number because they kind of don't care. How do you, how do you draw them in? You know, how do you get it for the people where the story, I mean, they've read every George R. R. Martin book, you know, mm-hmm. They've lived fantasy stories for 25 years. So there's no story you're going to suddenly tell at the table that's going to completely compel them. You know, how do you draw them in to some of the skill challenges that you design? And have you had to deal with situations like that?
Generally, you know, I've been lucky. I haven't had too many people like who are just plain resistant, and most people I found, you know, if I can, you know, if they're going to give me a chance, if they're resistant, I can usually turn them around in an instant, right? Like just sort of, you know, just change what they think about it. But in general though, like sort of when dealing with that sort of engaging people with it, like I find that the biggest thing is to, cause even like tactical players, you know, they care about, like, you know, if there's one thing that they care about, it's their piece in the game.
Right.
Right. You know, it's their character. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you can find ways in, you know, within, you know, maybe the plot or the subplot of a skill challenge to put stakes in there for it, or you can find some way to get the character to be invested somehow, like sort of let the player set a goal. Mm-hmm. And make a skill challenge around something like that, you know, like get the character involved and make it personal.
Right.
If you can, is a good way to get them involved in the story generally and in the skill challenge.
Right.
There. So, you know, if they're maybe out searching for something, maybe you could give them sort of maybe some sort of rival that they're competing at, like they're not just searching for it on their own. They're trying to, like I've done a lot of times where they do sort of competitive skill challenges where I'll have NPCs where who I'm rolling skill rolls for, and they're doing opposed checks. Mm-hmm. So now it's like a competitive thing again, right. Right? You know, sort of appealing to that competitive side, like, oh no, you're not just trying to roll dice. You're trying to beat me, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and whoever I represent.
Right. Right. Did you ever, and I always hate when the question was, so how great am I? That's a question. But did you ever take a look at the skill challenge worksheet idea that I put together?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you? And I expect a fully brutal and honest opinion of it. What do you think of a technique like that for kind of, you know, pulling the curtain back and exposing the mechanics completely? As a way, because one thing I found is that for those really mm-hmm. tactical players, as soon as I threw that piece of paper on the ground, they were back into it again. Because now it was like, you know, hey,
they had the numbers in front of them, right? Yeah, the numbers in front of them, and you could, yeah, no, I actually thought that was really good. I mean, one thing I've been doing in my games is I've turned my games into, and it's not like I ever hid stuff from players because mm-hmm. you know I don't want you to have it. It's just I didn't want to emphasize the numbers of it right. in a lot of aspects of it. Right. But I've recently just gone complete transparency, and then even went so far as to sort of make things up for negotiation or debate.
Right.
In terms of sort of story, like, you know, I'll give them a DC and be like, hey, if you want to, you know, if you have some argument of why something is going to make that easier, you can lower that DC. But alternatively, like, I let them get like extra sort of bonus points if they find things that made the DC harder.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. So, yeah, like I'm all for transparency and that stuff, because like you're saying, it can get players engaged on a whole other level, because if they don't know the number, what can they latch on to?
Well, and then they say, like, that's when they start chasing that high score again, right? Then they're, right. Then they're saying, like, okay, I don't know what the DC is. I'm going to assume it sucks. So I'm going to pick my most, you know, my biggest thing and try to just come up with some BS to, you know, con the DM into saying that I can do Arcana.
Right.
Because my Arcana skill is so high. But, I think I heard Phil Menard, the chatty DM, I think that was the first time I heard it, where he talked about how he completely exposes all of the numbers and all the mechanics. I'm not quite there, but I do it with skill checks, and certainly if they ask and say, like, I don't know, what's the DC, I'll tell them, you know, be like, it's 13. And, you know, I wish I would do that more. Sometimes I just forget to, because I'm sitting behind the DM screen and I just look at the screen and look at the number. And I don't, you know, I want to expose it. But yeah, those few times where I've passed that sheet around, and I heard criticism of it, and I agreed with the criticism that, you know, when you expose it that much, it becomes just another mechanical thing. And then it's like they're doing SATs while they're, you know, playing their RPG, and instead of actually caring about the story again. So I kind of have to draw them in to say, like, okay, when they're doing this, what are they actually doing? You know, like I had to write it differently. And I think I had three examples on the site, and there was a clear difference between the three, because the bottom one was the one that I had used most recently, and the top one was the one I had done furthest away, and they clearly got better. And people are like, I don't know why your first one's so terrible when your third one's so good. And they're like, because they are, because it is. But I think there's a lot of, I think it's certainly worth people trying out full exposure of DC. Certainly, you know, like I can still, you know, I think it'll be a long time before I completely roll in the open Chris Perkins style. But I think that exposing DCs is something, particularly for skill challenges, and particularly when people aren't really that crazy about them. I'm willing to try anything, you know, to get them in. And speaking of trying anything, have you? How do you weave in puzzles and physical stuff into skill challenges? Is that something you've done before? And if so, how did you do it? And how did it work out? And what are some examples?
I had one.
It's like four questions.
But. Yeah, it's a layered question. It's a skill challenge.
You better not get three failures.
Wrong. I will use history to test my recall. I have to say that first, before I start here, that I'm totally jealous of the Jenga thing you did for the psionics.
Hey man, steal it.
That was brilliant.
I forget how much a set of Jenga cost, but the funny thing is I had the thing in my closet for like 4 months. I'm whipping that out. And then the funny thing is the first time I used it just because I only had one player there and everyone else was stuck in traffic. And he was like, hey, I want to change some stuff in my character and move him from a defiler into a preserver, you know, how do I do that? And I said, well, let's get some Jenga out, you know. And it was him versus the sentient presence of a dead sorcerer king that he had in an orb.
And, nice.
And it was fun. It was just the two of us playing Jenga. Of course, we weren't playing Jenga, right? But it served the purpose.
Yeah, do what you need to do. So then, because I'm going to get back to that in a second too, is a good example of some principles of it. I think for me, one of the first ones I used was I had like a puzzle. This was more of a prop one than it was an in-game puzzle that had a prop, like where they were basically trying to unearth to translate this. This sort of a rune thing on a stone.
Right.
And then as they got parts of the skill challenge right, I had the fragments of the phrase in there so that, you know, they're sort of unlocking it and they were sort of, you know, okay, like instead of keeping tokens for the skill challenge, mm-hmm. the words that they were translating were the markers that they were getting it right.
Right.
And I haven't gotten a chance to use puzzles in there or like games within it. I've designed a few, just haven't gotten around to playing them. Right. But I think one of the important themes for that is you make the game, you know, figure out the game, and then use skills to make the game easier to play. Because, like, the first thing when you use, like, an actual game is people will go, you know, well, what if my character is not a great Jenga player or right. a good poker player or, you know, whatever, right? You're relying on player skill. But how you can sort of show how cool your character is by allowing skill checks mm-hmm. to let you cheat, mm-hmm. right? Like, if you were playing poker, right, you know, you can make an insight check
right.
to look at one of your opponent's cards. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Like, and you can use the tools that your character use
yeah, that's a really
to then augment the game. And so, you know, if you do that, then it's like, oh, I feel how cool my character is because, you know, he lets me do this thing that I'm otherwise horrible.
Mm-hmm. I'm stealing that poker playing and cheating by using skill challenges. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I've never played Three Dragon Ante, but I imagine if you incorporate that into your game, mm-hmm. that's kind of a puzzle, you know, a puzzle thing.
Yeah, that would be a perfect, one.
You could certainly use bluffs to, you know, give you some advantages. Mm-hmm. That was actually something with the Jenga puzzle that I did. There was a couple things I did with that. One was skill checks gave advantages to the player because I didn't want it to be even. You know, I mean, like D&D, right. all the mechanics in D&D are generally in the favor of the player, and you want them to be in the favor of the player. Mm-hmm. So, like death saves and everything else is always 55% towards player and 45% to them. You know, the nether, and so with Jenga, it was things like if you were adjacent, you know, the more people that were adjacent to the big boss that they were trying to defeat psionically, then the more tiles I had to pull for every tile that they pulled, you know, and it meant that they had a clear reason why they wanted to get closer. And mm-hmm. you know, that actually meant they had to move around the map some, which I always like. I always like any kind of weird challenge or anything that,
yeah,
that moves people around the map. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, you know, that's a good important piece. Have you ever used any like paper puzzles, Sudokus, or anything like that as a skill challenge mechanic?
No, I haven't. It's funny when I build my skill challenges, I tend to build them more like mini games in and of themselves.
Right.
But I feel like I could save myself a little effort because it's sort of exhausting to do it that way. Mm-hmm. By using something like Sudoku and, mm-hmm. and leaning on games that are already made.
Right.
To start.
And it's pretty easy to like replace all the numbers with weird symbols. And then, you know, part of the challenge is they have to figure out what the weird symbols are.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, you know, what are the nine? There must be nine different weird symbols. So,
right.
you know, what are? Let's get those down. But it was kind of fun to watch my crazier puzzle players chomp on that. And then I like doing that in the middle of a fight. So there's one guy that's working on that. Stop yelling! I can't get this thing. So that's always kind of fun. So how about skill? Well, hang on. So do you prefer more simple skill, a series of simple skill challenges, or do you like larger, bigger? You know, single complex challenges. Like one situation with lots of skill checks, or four or five smaller situations with a fewer number of skill checks.
There's something to be said for both. For me, it's sort of like, what's the place in the story, right? Like I had one of my funnest skill challenges I ever did and it took an hour and a half to run. Mm-hmm. It was a huge one. It was basically they were being attacked in their dreams by one of the main bad guys there. So it was this huge dream sequence, and it was all just one big skill challenge where the characters were confronting things from their past and stuff like that. And that was huge max complexity skill challenges, actually. It's one of the things on the site that I did, mm-hmm. and you know that can take a while, but it was a huge thing, so I didn't mind doing that, and we all had fun. But for a lot of things, for most of the time, I aim for short and sweet, and then I'll have set piece skill challenges, which will be longer.
Right. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I think I heard Mike Merles talk about it early on, and he said, you know, if you're doing just a bunch of skill checks, that's not a skill challenge. Those are just individual skill checks. And, you know, but sometimes it's better to have, if you have a whole scene, like, you know, the PCs are all running through a town escaping or, you know, escaping from, you know, assassins and guards, then a series of smaller skill checks of each situation, like a quick negotiation with a farmer to hide in his, you know, haystack, might be one small set of, you know, quick skill challenge, and or the whole thing might be one giant one. And I think he leaned towards the series of smaller ones, but you know, I don't know. I tend to go with medium size ones, you know, one normal size skill challenge rather than a series of small ones or a real big one. How do you handle penalties for skill challenges? What do you, you know, I know there's a couple trains of thought about what to do when people start failing their skill checks. What is your philosophy, and, you know, beyond the philosophy, what are the specific penalties that you would use or have used that were pretty successful?
So one of the big themes guiding me in failure is, I'll pretty much, I think I said this earlier, but I'll repeat. Basically, if any player wants to win a skill challenge bad enough, I will let them. Mm-hmm. But it will cost them, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a bit of a Faustian GM in that way. Right. You know, it's just sort of like, you know, how much do you want to offer? So I'll let people, you know, it's rare that people fail skill challenges in my game that they care about.
Right.
But when they don't care about them, you know, so knowing that I give people plenty of opportunity to sort of bargain their way out of failure, then I just let failure be what it is. Right.
So, you know, what are those costs? What are examples of those costs?
Oh, a lot of different things. A lot of times they make it up on the fly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I might, depending on the situation, the cost might be healing surge. The cost might be, you know, they don't, you know, they give me an encounter power, you know, that they can't use on their next fight. Mm-hmm. You know, they might take a penalty to a defense.
So those costs really are the penalties.
Yeah. Those costs become penalties, but they become longer term penalties, but get them out in the short term.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, all skill challenges need to be designed. This is kind of skill challenge 101, right? That all skill challenges need to be designed so that failure is an option.
Right.
You know, or else they're not. I mean, whoever has a skill challenge, oh, sorry, you're all dead.
You
know, yeah. You're crushed by the big boulder. I'm sorry. Like, well, you know, you could have landed on your feet and fought off all those native guys that were aiming spears at you, but you were a little slow and you fell face first, and now Belloc has the idol. You know, that's kind of the typical success and failures of a skill challenge. But finding new and interesting ways to take someone's healing surges is something that I always struggle with. You know, they just like, oh God, I just lost more healing surges. And like Dark Sun, you know, I ran a Dark Sun campaign for a little while, and, you know, anytime they're crossing the desert, you want to run a skill challenge for it and, you know, I don't know, take food away or, you know, start them all off in the battle weakened. But it can be hard to come up with, new and creative ways. Have you heard much about the Mouse Guard style of challenges where, you know, failures just simply change the story? There's no real penalty, right? There's just the story goes in a different direction than it typically did. Have you ever tried something like that? And
yeah, I mean, that's generally how I do them. It's just sort of like, I think it's best to treat skill challenges, never treat them like gates. Always treat them like forks in the story, right? You know, either this is going to happen or that's going to happen, right? You know, the good guy, you know, the bad guy's going to get away or he's going to get caught. But each of those things moves the story in a particular way. But the story's always moving, you know, and you don't want to make it too much of a setback of like, oh, well, now you know you couldn't find that, so now it took you 2 years to get there instead of 10 days, right? You know, don't make it severe like that. Just alter how you're going to come out of it.
Yeah, and a good DM is fully willing and accepting that either of those forks could occur. Right? Mm-hmm. They're not like, no, one way or the other, those PCs are ending up in jail. You know, that's not a that makes for boring storytelling. You know, don't run a skill challenge if you know they're already going to be in jail.
Yeah, and I think that's a general kind of a theme in general. Like, as a GM, you have to be willing to stick to your guns, and by guns, I mean you have to stick to what happens.
Right.
Right. You know, it's not satisfying ultimately for the GM, and definitely not for the players, where it's just like, oh, well, this happened, but I didn't want to write it that way, so we're going to make it do this, right? It's just like play the ball where it lands.
Right. Which can be pretty challenging.
Yes.
For me. I mean, it can be pretty challenging anyway, but I think it's, you know, I've always struggled with that because, you know, I think, and my style of kind of building a game and DMing, I think, is different than a lot of people. Because I almost always start with the encounters and like, okay, I know what battles are going to happen. And I mean, they're tied to a story, of course, but you know, I don't fill in all the details on the story until I have an idea of like, okay, I think this is the encounters that we're going to have, which means mm-hmm. that there aren't, you know, all the forks have to happen at the end of the game. So I know where we're going the next week
mm-hmm.
and they might enter an encounter differently one way or the other, depending on how a fork goes. But I still know that, okay, regardless of what fork they take, they're still ending up in this room because I just spent an hour and a half setting up that room and I'm not about to throw that away.
Right.
So that can be tricky. But I've seen people like a game that I play in regularly now. The DM is very good, and he you know, he uses dungeon tiles and everything else, and he will build four or five different possible paths, and he has them ready. And you know, he might reuse them later, or he might do something else. But if we pick a direction, he goes with that direction.
Well, you know, something that's handy for that too is that's why I'm obsessive with poster maps.
Yeah, right.
You know, and you can just keep poster maps around for like a certain region or something. Sure. So it's like, oh, you ended up here. Here's a poster map.
Yeah,
and go.
Yeah, Dragon Age actually did that in the PC and console gaming. Right, they had mm-hmm. kind of these mini encounters that would take place, and they all use kind of the same section of a city square. So they didn't mm-hmm. have to rebuild it. And I often thought that, you know, you could whip out your dungeon tiles and you could just kind of build a generic dungeon room with mm-hmm. a few interesting effects and say, like, I don't know exactly how I'm going to use that, but I bet I can use it five different ways if I need it. And, yeah, I think, like, I turned a stable into a brothel at one point, or not a brothel, but like a hot tub, you know, complex. And, you know, those poster maps can save you.
Yeah,
you know, when you have a lot of flexibility in what people do, mm-hmm. so yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that a lot. And unfortunately, my favorite favorite accessory for building out encounters, Dwarven Forge, does not do well with that at all because it's like you ain't moving it once it's there, and it takes a fair bit of time to set it up. So you're going to use it, but mm-hmm. But I think there's a bunch of different ways to do it, and poster maps can be very effective. So talking about encounters and stuff like that, how do you feel about skill challenges as part of combat? And, you know, what are some ways that people can, you know, what are some tips for kind of using skill challenges inside of a battle? Is that something you do regularly? Is it something you avoid?
I'll have it. Sometimes it comes up spontaneously. Other times I design it into it. Like I had one of my favorite ones in recent memory was they had this they were fighting on this bridge against this sort of hunchback type mm-hmm. It's basically like a hunchback ogre who's sort of maneuvering around the bridge and popping out of the shadows and stuff while the bell rang, and so the loud ringing bell that was near him was sort of keeping them off balance. But if they could stop the disarm it the bell mm-hmm. Then when the bell was no longer ringing, it basically brought an end to the combat because he sort of wanted the protection of having the loud bells
right
there. And, you know, so yeah, like having that skill challenge in there whilst they're fighting this, you know, basically like this hunchback ninja ogre. and, you know, the thief's trying to disarm and get
the thing's ogre mage, kind of like a ninja ogre.
A little bit. Yeah. Yeah.
The Oni.
Yeah, the Oni. Yeah, it was a little ninja ogre, ninja slash wizard.
Right.
But yeah, you know, basically it's sort of, I look at it as another thread that you can put in the combat. Like, okay, here's, you know, the first level that the combat's working there, fighting X, right? And here is like another thread where, you know, maybe it's a hazard that they're trying to deal with. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's something that they can use to end the encounter. Mm-hmm. You know, I try not to put too many things like that on there. Like one or two usually doesn't. Anything else becomes just too much to manage with the combat as well.
Right.
And then, you know, the one thing that I think is really important to do is to make skills a minor action.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you know, if you cost players too many actions.
Yeah, they won't do it.
They won't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I learned pretty early on. I don't remember where I first heard about using skill challenges inside combat. And actually, Chris Sims showed me a couple different things that he did in his Welcome to Dark Sun Bitches adventure. Did you play in that? Were you in that?
No, I didn't get a, last I year? No, I didn't get a chance to be in that.
Yeah, I didn't either. I totally screwed up and missed his and did something stupid instead. But one of the things that I saw he did is he gives you, you know, much better options if you use a standard, but you don't have to. And mm-hmm. I started using that in games where it's kind of like reckless, you know, reckless skill checks where, well, if you're going to do it and you're not paying attention to it, it's going to be a harder DC and the penalty is going to be worse.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but it only costs you a minor. Or you can be safe and you can spend mm-hmm. a standard on it. And the DC will be lower and there won't be a penalty because, you know, you can pull back. So it's like if you're closing a gate and you're trying to do so recklessly, well, screwing with the magic of a gate could result in heavy damage to you if you do it wrong. And the yeah. check is higher. Right. But if you take your time and do it right, the check will be, you know, medium instead of high. And there you can pull out before it's going to explode on you. Oh, that's a terrible metaphor. But you know, you're not going to take damage
from right.
messing with the gate.
Right. So, you can take more time to reduce risk.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I found that to be very effective in my own
game. Yeah, but
having an option for minor actions is absolutely critical because they will just skip it. Particularly for terrain effects too. I've seen if you have a terrain effect, like, you know, there's a giant crossbow, you know, they will avoid it like the plague if they think it's going to take a standard action to use it because they're mm-hmm. like, I know what my powers do. You know, I don't know what that stupid crossbow does, but I'm guessing it ain't going to do what my awesome encounter power is going to do.
Right.
So, A, it should do what an encounter power ought to do. But B, you need to let them do it as a minor so that they still have their standard.
So, right.
Yeah. That's a very good tip.
Yeah, it's totally important.
What else have you, what other tricks have you seen for using skill challenges in combat?
Good skill challenge stuff in combat. One thing that one place I end up seeing them a lot is so it's a two part thing. What one thing I like doing is having sort of unlocks in the combat. Mm-hmm. So where it'll be like, okay, we're fighting, and then I'll be like, hey, who here is trained in Arcana? Mm-hmm. You know, and people give a show of hands, and it's like, you people see this, mm-hmm. right? You know, and you see this blob of energy, you know, that's imperceptible to everyone else there, right? And you know that it does this, and you can interact with that if you choose, right? Like, so you can sort of like use this, what people have trained mm-hmm. to sort of unlock new skill challenges in there, you know, and you know, or possibilities of like, oh, if you have athletics, you can use, you know, there's a chandelier in the room, and you can just use that like a instead of having them roll for it. You know, you're just like, if you have, you know, athletics trained, you can, if you're standing in this spot, you can use this terrain power of the chandelier.
Right.
Of like jump off and swing from it.
Right. Right.
So sometimes you can make the skill use almost just sort of like a key just by being trained. Oh, here's something cool that you could do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I have is a lot of times I'll have skill challenges at the end where people are trying to chase the bad guy or they're trying to stop fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, and then that turns and, you know, like all of a sudden the combat pauses or stops and becomes a skill challenge.
Right. Right. Yeah. I've seen it. Like, enemy runs away mm-hmm. you're going to go chase him down through the city streets, and it goes from battle to skill challenge.
Right.
Yeah, I talked to Dave Chalker for quite a while about the out, you know, the mm-hmm. combat out. And I think a big easy way to add combat outs into encounters, you know, a combat out is a way to end a battle early, gracefully, you know, end a battle, you know, find a solution to a battle that isn't just kill everything on the map, which means that you can speed up combat, and it makes combat more interesting when you have a different kind of goal than just kill everything. And skill challenges many times play a big role in that, you know, that if you have a couple of demons and there's portals that are, you know, the demons came out of these portals. Well, if you manage to close the portal, you do, you know, the bloodied value worth of damage to the demon.
Right.
So that you've now cut your battle a lot shorter by adding in these skill challenges. Is that something you've also seen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. If you can win this, then it has this sort of big effect on the battle that either explicitly closes it or leads to it wrapping up very soon.
Right. So now I want to talk about something that I know is near and dear to your heart, which is adding skill challenges into monsters. And particularly, I think that skill challenges play, or skill checks anyway. Mm-hmm. I think you could probably say that skill challenges flow into the monster concept mm-hmm. that you put together, which is the World Breaker. Can you describe what a World Breaker is?
Sure. A World Breaker is a solo monster that basically sort of it's sort of like a super solo in a way. A lot of it's taken from sort of video games. It sort of transforms this environment around it at certain points mm-hmm. To represent a different challenge to the players. Mm-hmm. In that good example, I guess, is the first one we have out, Aether Kai, the Nightmare Dragon. Mm-hmm. This dragon basically that's, you know, the short story of it has been tortured for a century and has all this draconic and psionic might that has now become really warped and twisted mm-hmm. and is able to sort of manifest the energy of nightmares to fight players with. So basically you're fighting this weird scarred dragon and it's attacking you relatively normally, and then when it gets bloodied it summons these wells of nightmarish force all over the battlefield mm-hmm. And then there's this big transformation and then it unlocks different powers that it can fight you with.
Right Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in case people haven't seen the World Breakers that you've put up on your site, and if they shame on you if you haven't, they're kind of even bigger versions of some of the solo monsters I've seen in the Monster Manual 3. You know, Monster Manual 3 had a few different solo monsters that included effects that were similar to that. Mm-hmm. Imix, the fire, the mm-hmm. elemental, you know, elemental prince of fire, had the ability to kind of summon minions that mm-hmm. he would kind of bring into different play. Loth transforms halfway mm-hmm. through the battle from one monster into another mm-hmm. and things like that. But I think you've taken it even, you know, taken that even a step further with a full kind of, you know, the monster is the encounter rather than separate entities. How are skills kind of worked into World Breakers?
Two major ways. The first way is when I'll use Aether Kai here. When Aether Kai first makes that big transformation and summons the Nightmare Whelms, his World Breaker power is called Nightmare Gates. When he opens the Nightmare Gates, basically players get, as a free action, sort of like a way that they're going to respond mm-hmm. to it. So you know, one of the big things with the World Breakers is that there's a lot of points for player interaction. So Aether Kai, I won't lie, does horrible things. he does horrible things, but there's very little horrible things that he does that players don't have some sort of input on.
Right.
Sometimes they get to choose what horrible effect gets put on them. Right. And things like that. And in here, they get to, on the opening, they get to figure out of usually anywhere from two to four different tactics, they get to sort of pick which tactic they want and then try and make a skill roll. And then that will give them some bonus against something horrible he's going to try and do to them. So he does like a lot of necrotic energy. You might use one that gives you, resist 5 necrotic, you know, and then make a skill roll there. So you have that first thing right at the gate when he triggers at you a response. And then some of his powers are actually opposed skill checks. There, so he has one where he summons minions, basically plucks, he creates minions out of your nightmares, and then that's an opposed skill check for his intimidate versus there are like 2 or 3 skills that you can choose to oppose him with, and then you get like an advantage against him. I believe you get combat advantage against him for a turn if you win, but if he wins, he summons a minion.
That's interesting. And then that's something that they can still deal with. So even if they lose, you know, it's not awful. It's just, you know, they've got this other thing they have to worry about.
Yeah.
That's cool. Are there ways that, people can kind of add, you know, I think a lot of DMs end up tweaking their monsters anyway, or certainly figuring out how their monster better interacts with the environment around them. Are there world breaker like concepts that people can add to existing monsters, or either monsters that they pull out of the books or monsters that they, you know, monsters that they would design themselves? Do you have any tips for that?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things that you can do. Starting first with the one I just mentioned, the opposed skill check ones. Those are one of my favorite ones in doing the play tests with the world breakers and stuff like that. There's something in just the sort of feel of the mechanic. There's something uniquely oppositional. Like normally a monster attacks by rolling an attack roll and just against your defense.
Right.
And, you know, and when the monster makes an opposed skill check for a power, it's sort of like you and me, bud, right? Like, like you and me are in a duel, right? You know, and you know, and make sure that there's something that the player gets if he wins, but then something that the monster does to them if the player loses. You can also obviously make skill challenges for, like, let's say you make a monster that's particularly strong in some way. Like I know you've done this, Mike, where you have sort of a monster that's pretty much invincible, right? But maybe there's some skill, like a skill challenge that you can use to drop him of the invincibility, right? Like, you know, you see, oh, well, I see that you're here, you know, like you have this chink in your armor.
Right.
You know, and we can, you know, disarm you that way. And then I guess those are the two big ones, actually. Those are two big ones that you can really use to make skills a part of the monster fight.
Right. Yeah. When I got into the epic tier, there, you know, I noticed a bunch of different things that kind of changed how the game changed when people got to epic. And one of them was just, you know, incredible amounts of nuke damage. You know, they could just really pour damage out in a small amount of time. And it meant that anytime you put an elite and didn't protect that elite guy was dead in the first round, like almost every time. So, yeah, I did a lot of skill challenges where I think I had like a Death Knight whose armor was his defenses were 8 higher than normal. So, you know, I mean, 10 higher than normal means that generally players aren't going to hit him. And 8 higher means that it's going to be really hard to hit him. You know, they got maybe an, 10 to 20% chance that they're going to hit him. But with, he had these like 4 altar things. And when he screwed with the altars, you know, with a series of skill checks, his defenses would drop, you know, 2 each one. So the nice thing about that is they could just hammer on him if they wanted to. You know, they could get combat advantage on him and try to, you know, add boosts, and warlords could boost people's attacks until eventually they could get the numbers down to the point where they could actually hit him. And that's a fine option. Or they can go after these altars and drop his defenses another way. So I did that for, I think I did that for a couple, and I certainly did that for Orcus. You know, Orcus, when I ran him at level 30. And by the way, at level 30 play is just, you know, very painful. you know, you have to have stuff like that. And I had, you know, 4 major defenses that he had, you know, 4 major, like he had a damage shield that reversed damage back to the person that hit him. And he had a, you know, 80 points of regen every turn and, you know, DR 20 on all hits. You know, he would resist 20 on all hits. And I forget something else, you know, something equally painful. And you had to break these altars down before you could even start really hitting him. And that was, honestly, it was just there to kind of elongate, you know, it was to give him at least two or three rounds where he could actually do something before you just shoot him. So, you know, and that worked out. Oh, that was kind of annoying because, you know, they're like, every time I see four things in the corners of the room, I know, go for the four things. You know, hey, look, four more random objects I've got to go mess with in order to do whatever it is I was supposed to do when I showed up in the first place. So it's really easy for people to get cynical. And I have a hard time because I think I've found kind of a mathematical, you know, sweet spot for setting up skill challenges in combat and skill challenges tied to a monster. Or tied to an environment, for that example. And that seems to be two skill checks for four objects that are done as minor actions once per turn, and you know, or once per round. And that way, like, players can kind of split up and hit them all, but it generally means they're going to last about three rounds, you know, 3 to 4 rounds. And it's not going to really eat too much, too many actions from the players if you do it that way. And then the alternative is you have two objects that require three skill checks each, but can only be done once per round, you know, and that'll last... You know, that'll last three rounds, about a little bit more than three rounds sometimes. The problem is, like, the players just start to see that, you know, they see it all the time, and they can tell when you're doing it. And it's like, you know, it's funny because we're in a totally different game world now, but there's still bosses that have four objects that I have to go mess with to break through their shields. And I'm like, yeah, it's because everything else is either too short or too long. So that's a hard thing to, you know, to deal with. And people just gotta say, hey, it's just like everything wears armor. You know, boss mobs have four things. You know, four generic totems, or four guys that you have to save, or four bottles of liquid that you have to mix together, or four portals you have to close, whatever the hell they are, happen to be. You know, so that's a real trick. So do you have any closing thoughts about how people can improve skill challenges after our talk? Any final tips that you want to impose that you haven't really been able to cover?
One last one. One thing I consider doing that really sort of the one thing that I like to do that really sort of shakes up skill challenges is if you can make them oppositional and sort of like races whenever possible. Like, you know, we're trying to get to this thing before this person, right? And, you know, we're trying to, instead of going till we get three failures, we're trying to get to 10 whatever before this guy or this group gets to that same number.
That's pretty interesting.
And so when you have that, when you have the racing tally thing, it adds a sort of competitive, like, oh my god, like, you know, it works really well for chases, for competitions, for like us versus them, like a tug of war type situation. Fits a lot of different scenarios really well.
Yeah, you could even do kind of longer term things of like your group and another group are both trying to dig up these archaeological, you know, magical items, and how many are you going to get before they manage to get the other ones?
You know, exactly.
It could be like a longer montage, you know, like this is a two week or month long montage about who's going to rescue the artifacts before the other group. And then those will come into play when you or the other group have a slight advantage over the other one because, you know, you or they manage to succeed first.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. When you
use those, do you do flat DCs or do you actually kind of have statistics for the other guys that they roll as well?
Variable. It'll depend. Sometimes, if the NPC is important, basically if they have a name, then I'll give them stats. And then sort of, you know, another thing I like to do is sort of make it, you know, let's say if you had three skills, like if you had stealth, perception, and insight as the three skills, you can sort of also mix it as, okay, this one's going to be a stealth roll. This one's going to be perception. And obviously I don't make the NPC good at every one. So they might have an advantage in one, a disadvantage in another. Or, you know, and maybe be even in another.
Right.
And then the other thing, if they're not important, usually I just make it sort of like a random meter, like each turn that group rolls 1d4.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and they're just basically racing against what I roll.
Right. Right. Cool. Well, this has been a really useful conversation. I think I know I wish I had had this earlier, because I think there's a few tips, including, you know, playing poker and having them cheat with DCs, I think is, you know, a lot of advantages in learning how to do this right. So I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is great.
Great.